And so it was the high priest and the Sanhedrin that sent these Jewish soldiers or guards to capture Jesus. And so we now watch a highly formalized drama where the whole of the Jewish hierarchy, we're told, the whole Sanhedrin are there, the whole council of Judaism in a circle, and in the center stands Jesus. This is the official rejection of Jesus by his own religion. Here he becomes a heretic and an outcast from his own people. Remember John's gospel, he came unto his own and his own received him not. So that's what we're watching. What's it based on? Well, before we look at the drama, the quite powerful judgment scene, we know from John's gospel a couple of things. We know that there was a decision made by the Sanhedrin to get rid of Jesus, and of course that's not any, I mean, it's certain in a sense, otherwise the whole thing couldn't have happened. So sometime or other, near the end, the council, or a quorum of them, gathered and decided to get rid of Jesus by handing him over to Rome. So that much we can take as fact. Secondly, we know from John's gospel, which I'm just using now as an interesting parallel, we know that there was a scene in which at the house of the high priest, though actually it was Annas in John's gospel, there was this investigation, fairly secret one. Jesus was chucked into a prison at the back and kind of bashed up. But it's the Sanhedrin isn't there. So if you put these facts together, they're the basis of this drama. So we're not necessarily watching a moment in the last days of Jesus. We're watching a dramatic presentation of the significance of what's going to happen and what is happening. It's the whole of Judaism rejecting its Messiah. And that's really what happened. So we'll read now this dramatic portrayal, to look for the meaning in it and the significance of what's happening. We're looking under the history, if you like, to find the historical meaning. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest. Caiaphas was the son-in-law of Annas, was appointed high priest in the year 18 AD by the Roman occupying army. So at this time, which we're now probably 33 AD, he'd already been 15 years high priest, though the power was still really in the hands of his father-in-law, Annas. But Caiaphas is the figurehead and the official high priest. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, in whose house the scribes and elders had gathered. But Peter was following him at a distance. And it's meant to be really picked up at a distance. And we'll see the danger of following Jesus at a distance in a moment. As far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, Peter sat with the guards to see, literally, to see the end, or as they translate it here, to see how this would end. Now, Matthew tells us, the chief priests and the whole council. Now, as Matthew has presented this story, we've just had the Last Supper, haven't we? And it was a Passover festival. This is the evening. This is the feast of the Passover. It's impossible that the Sanhedrin would meet, the whole Sanhedrin would meet on the feast of the Passover. Quite impossible. So we can't be dealing with history here. Nothing would have validated that. They could. It was a shocking impossibility. And what happens all through the next day with the Sanhedrin and the others going up to Pilate, we're not dealing with historical data here presented simply. We're dealing with what happened. And it did happen, whether it happened this day or the day before, and that hardly matters. We're dealing with a dramatic presentation attempting to convey the awful reality of what happened on that Good Friday. So as we're seeing this, we're watching the chief priest and the whole council looking for false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward. Now, according to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 19, verse 15, and many other places, in Jewish law, you needed two witnesses to agree for a case to be upheld, for obvious reasons. So that's why he says two came forward. And they said, this fellow said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. The high priest stood up and said, have you no answer? What is it that they testify against you? But Jesus was silent. Let's look at that accusation for a moment. I'm able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. We've already heard twice about false testimony, so this was also thrown up at Jesus on the cross. We'll see it a bit later this evening. Chapter 27, the next chapter, verse 40. While Jesus is dying, this is hurled at him. You who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. So what might be the basis of that accusation? Now, in Matthew's Gospel, we get none, really. We have this, the only part I can find that in any way relates to it is Matthew chapter 12, verse 6, where Jesus says, I tell you, there's something greater than the temple here. A saying in which Jesus likens himself to the temple and presents himself as something greater than it, the place where God dwells. However, again, in a gospel where there seems to be no connection between Matthew and John, in John chapter 2, verse 19, and you might recall that in John's gospel, the emptying of the temple is put right up front. It's the first scene, really. So you've got the marriage feast of Cana and the emptying of the temple put together. The bride, the groom, and then the alternate religious system. So this is for dramatic purposes. And in that scene, the emptying of the temple in John, we read in chapter 2, verse 19, Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up. Practically the same statement. The Jews then said, this temple has been under construction for 46 years. And will you raise it up in 3 days? By the way, in brackets, that's another little hint in John's Gospel that helps us time the death of Jesus, or the ministry of Jesus. And by the temple being under construction, they mean Herod the Great's. It was the same temple, but he really extended it. Courtyards, the wall of Herod, which is still the Wailing Wall, enormous amount of construction to develop, support, and enlarge the temple precincts. So it's that building construction that they're talking about. But John adds, but Jesus was speaking of the temple of his body. So somewhere in the tradition, Jesus must have said something about the temple, about it, that's his body, being destroyed and being raised up on the third day or after 3 days. So that's the way the New Testament people understood this saying of Jesus. But it's taken out of context, thrown up at Jesus here in the trial as a false accusation. And then in verse 63, the high priest said to Jesus, I put you under oath before the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Now that's the key. Messiah equals Son of God. Please don't interfere with the scriptures by imagining a Trinitarian understanding of God in back in here in the New Testament times. That's a later theology. That's too confusing. The high priest isn't thinking about God the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. It's absolutely impossible. There's one God for the high priest, as there is for us, of course. The subtle Trinitarian doctrine of the New Testament has not been developed as a way into attempting to understand the mystery of God or to see the relation between Jesus and the Father. What he's asking here is a simple question. Are you the Messiah equals the Son of God? And remember that that's exactly what Peter said of Jesus back in chapter 16, verse 16. You are the Messiah, the Son of God. Are you the one God is sending? Are you the one who has God's life? Are you the one who makes who God is obvious to us? You, this scruffy Galilean carpenter's son, untrained, and certainly not one of the inner circle of the select Judean hierarchy. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. And Jesus said to the high priest, and he must answer him respectfully, as it were, he's being asked by his religion, who are you? And Jesus' answer is, you have said so. Now that phrase, you have said so, he also said that to Judas at one stage, a little earlier, and he's going to say it to Pilate. It's a way of saying yes, but with the qualification that the person making the statement does not understand what they're saying. I mean, these are your words. You're saying it, comma, but you don't understand what you're saying. Not the way you understand it. It's a not wholehearted yes, but it's not a denial. There's a truth in what you're saying, high priest, but your way of understanding it is quite wrong. How does Jesus understand who he is? Here it is, and this is the climax. We've been working up to this since, I've forgotten, chapter 8, I think, where the Son of Man was first mentioned, chapter 5, in Matthew's Gospel. Jesus continually identifies himself as the Son of Man. And some scholars say, and I think they're right, this is getting very, very, very close to the core of Jesus' self-understanding. And one reason we know that is because the expression Son of God was not a post-New Testament expression. You don't find it in any of the creeds of the church. It wasn't a useful way of talking about Jesus after the New Testament times. They call him all kinds of things, but you don't find him called the Son of Man. It's far too Jewish. And for its understanding, you have to get right back, as we've tried a number of times with you, to get back to the mentality of that period when Jesus was alive within the Jewish world. To a Greek, or to the non-Jewish world, it was an incomprehensible phrase. So that it's on the lips of Jesus constantly in the New Testament and never in the creeds, and that it's only on the lips of Jesus and he only uses it of himself, the high probability is that we're dealing here with an absolutely what Jesus actually said and how he understood himself. So that's a lovely thing to know, because the Gospels are not a psychological document taking us into Jesus' self-understanding very often. They're an objective document written in a time when that wasn't an interest. They wanted to say who Jesus really is, and they present him as he is. But how did he understand himself is a fascinating question for us. In our world where psychology is so interesting and we like to delve into the way things were, here's a marvelous hint, and I think a very direct line into Jesus' self-understanding. So back to it. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus says, they're your words for it, or yes, up to a point, you've said so. But I tell you, this is who I am. Whatever words you want to put on it, I want to put these on it. From now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power, coming on the clouds of heaven. Two Old Testament texts mixed in. The main one is Daniel chapter 7 verse 13, and quickly reminding you, because this is the climax of it. Back in the book of Daniel, you'll recall, book of Daniel written in the time of the Maccabean revolt, and the book of Daniel, they're in the middle of being persecuted, and they're being, killed, murdered, etc. And this is a book encouraging them to persevere to the end in their faith. And in the middle of it, Daniel chapter 7 has a scene of the last judgment. What are we going to be ultimately judged on? How does God from heaven view this crazy, mixed-up world that we're in? Well, he says the books were opened. They're the books of judgment in heaven, where ultimately reality is seen for what it really is. We don't see very well down here. So the books are open in this heavenly assize or judgment, and one like a son of man comes on the clouds of heaven. Quotation here. And on him is given glory and honour and majesty and all the high-powered words that are used there. God judges him to be right, not the great, powerful Syrian king who's trudging his way through the country and exercising this enormous authority and pseudo-power. And who does the Son of Man represent? We're told later in chapter 7, it's the poor, downcast, downtrodden, persecuted, wonderful, faithful, ordinary, beautiful people whose lives are being taken from them. In God's judgment, they are being vindicated. And the Son of Man, the one who's the ordinary man, the one who's like the ordinary people, he who identifies with them, represents them in the heavenly judgment. So here Jesus says, including in it now, a phrase from Psalm 110 verse 1, seated at the right hand of power, a messianic, one of the three messianic psalms, Psalm 110. Here's the Son of Man seated and coming on the clouds of heaven. So what have you got? Just watch it. You've got a crowd of 70 of the Sanhedrin round in a circle. You've got Jesus already been partly bashed up and dragged in and thrown into the middle of all these very important, well-dressed people with all their power and their mitres and their whatever. And they're judging him. He's there to be judged by us, important people. And the words of Jesus turn the whole thing totally on its head. They are being judged by what they're doing to him and to everyone he represents. Son of Man means me, Jesus saying, and all the poor with whom I am one. All those with whom I identify and whom I love. Anyone's welcome to be in that group. But they'll have to not be judges of others. They won't be the powerful exercising their power in this atrocious way. They'll be the persecuted, downtrodden, just like Jesus. So it's a total reversal. And the high priest tore his clothes and said, he has blasphemed. Blasphemed because he's claimed that God is vindicating Jesus and the rabble as against the hierarchy of the Jewish institution. Why do we still need witnesses? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your verdict? And they answered, he deserves to die. What's the basis of their judgment in law? Well, I'll present it to you now. There's a couple of places to look for it. But the best place is in Deuteronomy chapter 13, the first verses of that book. It says 15 there, but that's incorrect, it's 13. So Deuteronomy chapter 13 verse 1 reads like this. And you can picture Jesus right in this scene. If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams, appears among you and announces to you a miraculous sign or wonder, and no one could doubt that Jesus' life was wonderful, and if the sign or wonder of which he has spoken takes place, and he says, let's follow other gods, gods you have not known, let us worship them, you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. So even if he does miracles and wonders, but he's presenting a god other than Yahweh. And in the opinion of the high priest and the Sanhedrin, that's exactly what Jesus is doing. He's presenting a god who eats with sinners. He's presenting a god who forgives adultery. He presents a god who refuses to ostracize anyone. He presents a god who reaches out to the Gentiles and embraces them and talks about how wonderful their faith is. He presents a god that would break Judaism apart if people followed him. And of course that's what it did. It was meant to do that. They saw that as heresy. The Christian community saw it as a liberation of God from the constraints of the religious system of his day. So the text goes on. Yahweh your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and all your soul. Brackets. Or are you going to follow this Jesus from Galilee with all his newfangling ideas and popularism and lack of respect for authority and so on? It's Yahweh your God you must follow. Him you must revere. Brackets. And that means obey the high priest and the Sanhedrin and keep the baddies out and the goodies in and do what you're told and keep the Sabbath and don't cure people and all the rest of the religious claptrap. Keep his commands and obey him. Serve him and hold fast to him. That prophet or dreamer, Jesus had nice aspects to him. I'm sure the high priest thought he was could have been a nice bloke if he had been well educated, because he's kind and all that. He's not a real baddie. But he's a bit of a dreamer. And worse than that, he's undermining faith in Yahweh. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death, because he preaches rebellion against Yahweh your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. He has tried to turn you from the way the Lord your God commanded you to follow. You must purge the evil from among you. So it's on that basis that the high priest and the Sanhedrin have to, they believe, get rid of Jesus. I think myself I would suggest it's really important to presume, it's hard to, but I think we'd be wise to presume goodwill on the part of the Sanhedrin. If we look at them as baddies, we're less likely to see where we're like them, because no one likes to define themselves as a baddie. So if the Sanhedrin, they're probably very sincere. They're probably locked into a religious education that they can't get out of. I'm not trying to excuse them, but I just want to generously assume for the moment they may be quite good-willed, sincere people trying to hold on to the traditions which are drummed into them by their mum and dad and priests and so on. There's a lot more to it than that, psychologically and religiously, but that could well be it. And if I look at them that way, I might be tempted to look at myself and see, could I behave like this? Then I might come up with a startling truth that not only could I, but I have. Maybe you have. Maybe we can be pretty judgmental and pretty, in the name of the Catholic Catechism, perhaps, or the Pope, perhaps, or the Tridentine Church, perhaps, you know. This being open to recognize love when it is as surprising as Jesus is quite an extraordinary gift and quality. And I think life only teaches it to us very slowly, and it requires humility, a whole lot of virtues. And, of course, beautiful people, simple people, saw Jesus for what he was and went for it. And these people here had too much to lose, so we don't have to excuse them. But I think you see what I'm trying to do. If we presume basic, I don't think they would have seen themselves as at all crook. They may have been acting according to their convenient consciences, and we're not beyond doing that.